Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan. Before we get to today's show, I would like to begin thanking our recent sponsors. Thank you to Cypress C, who donated via our GoFundMe site. Thank you to the attendees of the Exploring Psychedelics Conference in Ashland, Oregon, who bought psychedelic parenting stickers at our table. Thank you as well to Chris Bennett for your donation of the copy of your book, Cannabis and the Soma Solution, which is a must-read for anyone interested in the role cannabis most likely played in the formation of religions, including ancient Judaism. Thank you as well to my dear friends Harmony Haney and her partner Sean, to Matt Vogel, and to Martin Ball and Jesslyn Jones for giving me places to stay during my trip to Ashland. Thank you to the kind people of the Santo Daime Church of the Holy Light of the Queen in Ashland, who welcomed me into their space and shared their medicine with me, and to Padrino Jonathan Goldman, who went out of his way to ensure that my experience ended with a sense of closure and protection. Thank you to the church members Lisa and Joseph for making sure that I got there and got home, and for welcoming me with open arms. Thank you again to Martin for his humble offerings of a healing space and for medicine that gave me eyes to see and a heart to feel eternity. What a blessing to truly know that all is love and all is one. The dude truly does abide, my friend. Thank you also to my new friends, Brad and Jennifer, for sharing the weekend's journeys with me. It wouldn't have turned out nearly so beautiful without your presence and insights. Here's to many more adventures together in the future. Finally, I wish to thank all of our listeners who have waited patiently for the last 3 weeks for a new show. After the profound experiences of my week in Ashland, I have been in a fairly deep state of integration, and I've focused almost exclusively on putting my energy and attention on my kids and my wife. In the next episode, I will share with you a bit of the experience that I had in Ashland and what a profound affirmation it was of my commitment to family and to the work that we are doing with this podcast and with our website. Without further ado, I would like now to introduce our guest for today's show, Zoe Helena. This conversation was recorded on 420 and Earth Day last week and comprised over 2 hours of great discussion. Because of this, we have decided to air it as a two-part episode. Part two will air next week at our regular Wednesday morning time slot. Zoe is a multidisciplinary artist and an animal rights activist. She is the founder of Cosmic Sister, which, through its Plant Spirit Grant, Women of the Psychedelic Renaissance, and Women of Cannabis Grants, is dedicated to recognizing and elevating feminist voices in the growing psychedelic renaissance and supporting visionary women in the exploding world of cannabis business and studies. Zoe is also the wife and partner of ethnobotanist, writer, and Fox News personality Chris Killam, and manages social media and web presence for The Medicine Hunter. Zoe has accompanied Chris on many trips to the Amazon and elsewhere, looking for healing plants and soul-transforming experiences. She's an artist, writer, journalist, and visionary explorer in her own right. Her writing has appeared in Boston Magazine, Forbes, Boston Globe, Alternet, Chicago Tribune, Newsday, MIT Technology Review, Utney Reader, and Fast Company. While she does not have children of her own, Zoe has in recent years found herself in the role of psychedelic mentor to a number of young people in the community. She has also deeply embraced her role as fairy goddess mother to a number of young people in her life, a term that she will explain in depth today. Welcome, Zoe, to Psychedelic Parenting.
Hi, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Happy good. 420.
Yes, it's a gorgeous 420 here in the Happy Valley.
Yeah.
The Pioneer Valley, all the little beautiful buds are just popping out all over today. It's like this is magic day.
Indeed.
Yes.
So, one of the things that got us interested in what you're working on is that our friend Nishay Devino got a grant from your organization, which is called the Spirit Plant and Women of the Psychedelic Renaissance Grant. And when we started talking about that with Nishay, I thought this is a really interesting story, and I'd like to hear it straight from you. So thanks for being on.
Great. No, Nishay is really lovely, and we actually met it in an interesting way. I'd love to tell you that story.
Oh, sure. Go for it.
You know, we were in an art opening in New York, and it was a psychedelic gathering, and Chris was going to speak the next day. And I knew of her because she was doing, I think, This Week in Psychedelics for Evolver or Reality Sound, which I believe that's how I knew her name. But I didn't know what she looked like, and I just saw this interesting young woman, really shy, and I was around all these sort of, you know, marketing communication types that were really extrovert.
Yeah.
And just thought, I've always liked the people that are, you know, on the sidelines. Sometimes they're the best. So I just went over to her, and I don't know how, why this came out, but I just said, "Are you an artist?" And she says, "I am." It was like, that was it. We were instant friends. Because I don't know why I even said that. So years later, you know, she's just doing so well. And it just occurred to me that she might want to have the experience of ayahuasca in the Amazon. So the original grant, the grant that she's been given, two grants, the original grant, which is the ayahuasca grant, and that one is called the Plant Spirit Grant.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that supports women like Neshe to go to the Amazon, have the traditional experience in preferably Shipibo, but not always Shipibo environment. And then there's a second grant called the Women of the Psychedelic Renaissance Grant, which then supports her to write about it and publish her, you know, whatever it is her experience is, in some wonderful venue when she comes back.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about, you know, seeing what happens. You know, she's fantastic. And I really look forward to sharing ceremony with her and also, you know, just seeing what she comes up to. She's going to work on her poetics in the Maloka.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
It really is awesome. I'm very excited.
Yeah, that's great. Since it is 420, we were talking earlier and you said that your cosmic sister also extends a grant in relationship to cannabis. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, it's very similar to the Women of the Psychedelic Renaissance, and in fact comes from the same funding source. This is all part of a fiscal sponsorship with MAPS. And I like to say that because often the Cosmic Sisters of Cannabis grants and the Women of the Psychedelic Renaissance grants are, they overlap, because often women who are interested in cannabis have discovered cannabis through another psychedelic plant.
Or vice versa, yeah.
Yeah, or vice versa. It's very connected, not always, but with this boom that's happening here in the United States with cannabis, you know, it's really like, for me, I call it the cannabis liberation movement.
Yes, amen.
That's how it feels for me. And it's just fascinating to be part of. And that was a way that I could, even though it's all together, just like with the MAPS mission statement, they separate cannabis out because it's such a large category within the plant spirit category,
mm-hmm.
that it just, even though it's really the same, it's a sacred plant, and it can be a psychedelic plant, and we'll get to that, but mm-hmm. it is still so big because of what's going on here in the States, that in their mission statement, they separate it out. So I do as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And also, you know, just with 420, it's interesting because I have noticed this year more than ever, the cannabis media is booming.
Oh, yeah, people, it is.
You know, people are looking for 420 stories, just like in the last 10 years, I've been, well, I guess it's really been more like 5 years, I've been writing for, you know, eco-living, conscious living, lifestyle types of magazines and venues. Yeah. And they're always looking for something for spring, something for Mother's Day, holiday-related, you know, stories. Mm-hmm. There's certain types of seasonal stories. Well, 420 is now a big, big thing.
Yay. That's great.
So they're actively looking for stories, which I think is really fascinating.
See, and so now Bicycle Day is sort of like the hipster psychedelic holiday, because I don't have to explain 420 to anybody anymore, but I still usually have to explain Bicycle Day.
I don't know about Bicycle Day.
Oh, Bicycle Day is the 19th of April, and it is the anniversary of the day in 1943 when Albert Hoffman tested LSD on himself purposefully and then rode his bike home from work.
Oh.
So it's the anniversary of the first deliberate LSD trip.
How about that?
Yes.
Well, good to know, and I heard it from you.
Yeah, yesterday my wife and I went to, we took a bike ride across the campus, and then we went to the special collections room in the basement of the MSU library, and they have a first edition of Soma by Gordon Wasson there. So
okay.
It's got like these great like color paintings and photographs of fly agaric mushrooms, and they're like these really old, it's from like 1963, so like, you know, the pictures have that really like sort of hyper real like technicolor kind of appearance.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's just
1963, free. Mm.
It's vintage psychedelia. So yeah, we went out and had a really nice lunch with no children, which is hardly ever happens. So it was a beautiful day.
It was like a date day.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of vintage psychedelic, you know, I was born the next year. So you gotta watch what you say.
So you're saying you also are a vintage psychedelic.
I am. That's how I feel. I'm a vintage psychedelic chick. I mean, I was born in 1964. Uh-huh. And during that time, that really was the height of that particular era. And it really did influence me. I mean, I actually have that in some of my notes for this podcast, because I thought, you know, just trying to explain my background and when I came into the world, we had a good laugh about my being a baby boomer, and really I'm on the cusp.
Right.
Okay, I appreciate that, and I will contemplate that. But I do feel like, you know, the joke at the time was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but I was a child, so obviously the drugs and the sex part was really inappropriate uh-huh. for a child. But I was definitely around the, you know, whatever else counts as rock and roll. And my father was a teacher at a performing arts school. It was a merit-based school, so it was really quite an extraordinary place to be a child.
Uh-huh.
And those kids were in their teens, and they were doing everything.
Wow.
They were brilliant. And it was all about creativity and expression. And they were, you know, being trained by some of the finest artists of every discipline from all over the world.
Wow.
So that was my world for the first 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty much.
That's awesome. Kind of,
yeah, it is. And it was really something. I mean, I felt very safe. And part of the 60s movement with their age group was that it was a big deal at the time to think about children as people. I know that sounds crazy, but that's really true.
That's what we try to do. Yeah, I think that's really smart.
Yeah. Well, before that, though, it was children are seen and not heard, or children are to do what they're told. Or, you know, there was the idea in the 60s was the creative kid.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah. And so the young 60s, the kids of the 60s, you know, like the, you know, the older kids, the teens, uh-huh. teens yeah. and early 20s, they were proactively wanting to communicate with children.
Mm.
And that was a new thing.
Mm, that's interesting.
So I was kind of a mascot. I got really lucky.
Wow. Very cool.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, I was surrounded by it, but I didn't do it. And that brought something to mind I wanted to share with you. I think uh-huh. it's really important, is that during that era, you know, a lot of really creative things were going on. Like, you know, Where the Wild Things Are came out, 1963.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yellow Submarine was 1968. So I was 4 years old when I saw that.
Mm.
When you think of a child's mind, I think this is really important, because a child's mind is different.
Yeah.
You know, they don't need psychedelics. They are psychedelic.
Yes, right. Yes, definitely.
But the imagination is different. It's not been, you know, limited in the same way. And so I was a wildly creative person. Mm. The last thing in the world I would ever even imagine needing or wanting would be anything to do with like a psychedelic that wasn't self-induced.
Mm-hmm.
I know I had so much creativity. It was ridiculous. And that's I still awesome. Do. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, and the other thing on that note is my father was not at all into drug culture.
Uh-huh.
He's, you know, he's a scientist. And his concept was, and still is that you can create these altered states yourself, uh-huh. that this is natural and in the brain. And, you know, of course, he also likes to be in control. So, he bought a lot of the propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
That's the truth. But he's also a really great father. But I bought his propaganda. Mm. So it's not all bad, though. And I think it's important in this conversation, because he was my parent,
mm-hmm.
one of my parents.
Mm-hmm.
So his influence on me and the way I looked at psychedelics and cannabis was in that era when it was everywhere, right? And mm-hmm. all of his students were doing this stuff.
Right.
Right. And some of them were dropping out.
Yeah.
A couple of his students ended up, you know, leaving and going to New York. Because that was the thing. What was it? Tune in?
Turn on, tune in, drop out.
Thank you. They were, and they dropped out. You know, they were in this merit grant program where they didn't even have to pay to be at this amazing school. It's still there. Half of Broadway comes from the school.
Hmm.
So I kind of, when I'm saying that, I'm saying my father's a really brilliant man, and his his role, he was one of these people who is really a gifted teacher, and that was his calling, mm-hmm. was to teach. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with that. So the students were talked about at home. Like my mom and dad talked about, you know, people. I knew their names. I knew this. Oh, she's such an incredibly gifted dancer. She's going to be a prima ballerina. All this happened in our family, but they were all concerned about the drugs, you know. And some of them, you know, some of them were going into Hollywood, and you know, when Jesus Christ Superstar that came out, some of his students were in that, and they all were doing a lot of drugs, and many of them sort of, you know, disappeared.
Interesting.
Nobody really knows what happened to those kids. So in my family, it was dangerous.
Yeah.
Psychedelics were dangerous, and that you could lose your mind, or you could just kind of fall into the gutter somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And what a waste.
Yeah.
So that was the propaganda, you know? And the other side of that was you can do it yourself with your own mind and your own creativity. And I did until much later. So I wanted to bring that up because my psychedelic background is odd, I think. I think a lot of people did a lot more than I did. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't do anything until my early 20s, not even cannabis.
Mm.
My sisters were both doing that.
Mm-hmm. I didn't do any psychedelics until my 20s either. I did start cannabis fairly early, but my first LSD experience was my freshman year in college, and it was not a, like, you know, one of those sort of ego erasing experiences, but it was definitely like profound and had an impact on me. But I didn't have the really serious deep psychedelic experiences until I was a junior in college or sophomore year in college, I guess. So yeah.
That's the second year.
Second
right?
year. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was with me. It wasn't what happened to me is I was not going to touch anything. Mm-hmm. I was also a very ambitious student. Mm-hmm. I was on scholarship and going all the way and blah, blah, blah. So I was for good reasons. It wasn't ego based. I was really, really inspired. But I had been out of school for 3 years before I went to college. I left the house at 16 in New Zealand and went to the city to study acting for 3 years and animation. So I'd been out working for 3 years before I went to college in the United States, the same age everybody else was, just a freshman. Mm-hmm. So I had some different life experience. And after the first year, I moved from the campus to a little place with a boyfriend who was 5 years older.
Mm-hmm.
And he remembered the 60s in a different way. And there was a lot of cannabis present, I should say. I have to say his name was Kevin. I have to say Kevin was a full-on pothead. I mean, we were together for 5 years. So, I mean, with all love, because I have sweetness for him in my heart. You know, this was a guy who got up in the morning, big bong hit, got in the shower, got out of the shower, another big bong hit, went to work. Bong hit before going into work. Basically, the object of the game was to stay very stoned all day.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. And he was not himself when he wasn't stoned.
Uh-huh. Sure.
He was not happy. Because I thought, you know, all my propaganda was, oh, you're addicted, you need to stop. And he would try for me, but he just was not himself. I mean, and, you know, years later, you realize so many things, and I don't want to talk about him here, but I did finally realize that there were some really great people who I was very close to, who were, you know, bona fide potheads, and they were great. There was nothing wrong with them. They weren't insane. You know, they weren't, you know, dropouts, and they were just great people. So I just decided I would try, and I was a newbie. So I got extremely stoned.
Uh-huh.
And I mentioned this to you before, but that turns out to be my first psychedelic experience.
Hmm.
So
can I tell us about it?
Kind of apropos that it's, you know, 420. Well, I didn't realize it at the time. I was a little scared because of my programming, but there was a party downstairs with, we lived in sort of a, not a duplex, but there were four different apartments in this one place. We were upstairs and there were some people downstairs who we really liked, and they were having a party and everybody was, you know, smoking cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably pretty good weed is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So Kevin basically said, look, you know, it's the summer, you're not in school, you're fine. You know, I was working during the summers in a Shakespeare company. That's another story.
Oh, that's cool.
So I was free to just, you know, it was a weekend. I could I could do this. I could explore this. And I felt good. I was confident in myself. I was healthy. I was in my early 20s in a great relationship. It was good. So I was in a good set and setting. I just didn't know about that. Mm-hmm. And I felt safe. And so I, you know, he gave me one of his, you know, bong hits. And well, I basically did not go to the party.
Yeah.
I'm staying here, you go, which was downstairs. The party was downstairs. So I just stayed in our apartment mm-hmm. and I laid on the bed. This is it's a sexual story. I hope you don't mind.
It's fine.
But, you know, people talk about cannabis as an aphrodisiac. What was important, and I think this is interesting from this perspective now at 50, right? Mm-hmm. When you're in your early 20s, so much of it is about figuring out sex.
Yeah.
It's figuring out your own body. Like, how does this work?
Right.
This is why, mm-hmm. you know, for me, my first psychedelic experience on cannabis was, all I can tell you is it was like, I was not familiar with yoga. I'd seen it in the 70s, but it wasn't in my world. I did not know any of the art that would be like Alex Gray art, any of that. Didn't know any of that. I knew rainbows from New Zealand because there were many rainbows in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. But what I saw was like rainbows, like actual beautiful light colored rainbows,
oh,
all going through my body in a similar, I was studying, you know, figure drawing as part of my artwork in mm-hmm. school. So I knew the anatomy a little bit. It was somehow tracing inside my perception. It is so hard to describe a psychedelic
sure.
experience,
yeah. Yeah.
was that all this rainbow light was following the intricate channels of my body, mm. all of the nerve systems, the veins, everything just flowing through it in this amazing, beautiful, sensual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was light. And I'm laying on this bed and thinking, well, this is interesting. This is not what happens to Kevin when he gets up in the morning and goes to work. I'm assuming that's not what they're all feeling down there at the party.
Right.
You know, so maybe I'm sensitive and I think I'll just lay back here and explore this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided I would explore it. And I meditated. I just didn't know what that was. I had not studied meditation, but I was an artist, remember. I knew how to get into flow state.
Mm-hmm.
I was a very good artist, too. So I really knew how to go into a trance. And I went into it, and I allowed myself to experiment with that experience, if that makes sense.
Oh, totally.
In today's world, in the world I do work with ayahuasca, I would say I was navigating the experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized that it was sensual to the point of I was getting horny.
Yeah.
And I thought at that age, we had a great sex life, you know, I have to say. But I was still learning, and this is also has to do with feminism. I was learning what my body as a woman was capable of doing. How did an orgasm really work? And what would happen if I didn't even touch myself? Would I be capable of reaching orgasm with this psychedelic experience going through my body? And I know this is kind of like a psychedelic parenting thing, so I hope children don't listen to this.
No,
but
either.
I reached orgasm, and I never moved.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome.
It was a very healing experience. It's, you know, when I look back, I think, you know, that's just like the way people talk about a psychedelic experience. It was mm-hmm. a vision. It was a healing in the sense that I learned about myself and something that's very important at that time, because I realized, my goodness, if I'm capable of that, then the rest of it is really about bonding with the partner.
Right.
Right. Theoretically, anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was, you asked.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Yeah, Nicole and I have like written about, and we've talked about before, that there's, like our relationship is in some ways sort of like tied together with cannabis, that it's kind of like this three-way dance in a way. And the way that it like allows people to connect during sexual experiences, I think is like one of its most phenomenal properties.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
I can't believe we got on to this. It works. It's 420. It's so true. And I was just actually writing something for Mass Roots, which is one of the cannabis media pieces, and I was just writing some notes for that today, and I thought, you know, one of the pet peeves I have with all this is, you know, with the legalization issue, yeah. is how they break it up into medicinal or recreational.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a minute, there's so much else.
True.
You know, there's exploratory.
Right.
You know, like what we do in ayahuasca. You know, people are using cannabis for that. They're you know, I do all the time. I mean, I think that first experience I told you about, then after that, I began to use cannabis in different ways as an artist to break through my own, whatever it was that was holding me back from getting to the next level as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Usually technical. I literally would do that. I was very good technically
mm-hmm.
already. I'd already been a professional when I was in college. But I would get to a point where I knew my teachers can't teach me any more of this. I need to learn myself. And I would get high and I would focus and I would get myself to the next level. And it worked. So, you know, what is that? Is that medicine? Is that recreation? No.
It's self-improvement.
Yeah.
I think that it's also in some ways speaking to the most honest, most clear version of like what it means to be religious or have a religious experience. I mean, a lot of people don't like it when I say religious, but they want to say spiritual. To me, it's the same thing. I think it's
right, because you're religious. That's why.
right. But I think that it's pointing this experience that these medicines allow for opens up the ease at which those experiences can occur. And I think that they're indistinguishable in every respect from, like, you know, endogenously induced religious experiences.
So we could say medicinal, recreational, spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
We could also say that, you know, where does the aphrodisiac come in? Is that recreational? I don't think so. I think that's relational, maybe. Mm-hmm. Or so there's so
or
much
something
more
it's it. Or it's something that floats in between medicinal and recreational and spiritual, like it's, you know, there's something
about all of the above, right?
Yeah.
Well, my point is, it's so like the United States culture to simplify grossly.
Yeah.
You know, and it's become a pet peeve for me. I'm annoyed by it.
Yeah.
I see the writing on the wall, you know, until it all goes legal. And I guess it doesn't really even matter anymore. It just annoys me that they break it up like that.
Right.
So just wanted to mention
it would be interesting to compare the situation that we're in currently to essentially like during the Prohibition era in the 30s, because number one, you know, Christian church, like the Catholics didn't stop, you know, using wine in their masses during Prohibition, and you could go to Walgreens and buy like medicinal, like your doctor could prescribe medicinal whiskey for you, and you could go to Walgreens and buy whiskey during the Prohibition. In fact, apparently Walgreens made a significant amount of its money in the early years of its company, you know, selling medicinal whiskey.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, my mother, you know, she's 84, okay? She just never touched any kind of cannabis or anything like that, but she's surprisingly open. She's really interested in this work.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you know what she'll say? Anytime she's asked, Prohibition doesn't work.
Yep.
So I think being 84, she was a depression kid, you know? So she was really close to that period and she saw a lot of real damage.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, from her generation, when we're talking about mentoring and parenting, that's my mother.
Yep.
You know, I think that's really pretty amazing that she's so open to this work at this point in her life.
Indeed. Yeah, the viewpoints are definitely changing really rapidly. Something I'd like to have you talk about is we kind of were deciding about how we're going to formulate this conversation. And something just really funny came up. You mentioned that to a couple of your nieces and nephews and some children of friends, you are the fairy goddess mother. And
yes.
I thought that was a wonderful phrase, and I'd like you to share your experiences of being the psychedelic fairy goddess mother.
Oh, well, I think credit has to go to Charles Tim, and I'm going to use his whole name because he deserves it. One of my close friends from many, many years was one of the first close friends to have a child. And, like, I went through the whole pregnancy and all of that. And you know, obviously I had a real close connection. Now, she's quite religious, and she married a quite religious person, like Christian. So their view was they couldn't really make me the godmother because I'm not religious.
Right.
Okay, whatever. You know, her alter ego is Lucy from Charlie Brown. So, you know, I was like, right, got it. Okay. So, but what happened was ironic because she married a quite conservative man in Charlotte, North Carolina, mind you.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this child, however, he picked me. And he was about 3 years old. Beth and I had spent the day together catching up. I was already living in Boston. And we went to pick him up at Sunday school. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget walking in there and seeing him. And he was sitting, you know, with his friends sort of on the floor. They've been playing and doing art and whatever else they were doing. And he looked up and said, "That's my fairy goddess mother." And it was like instantaneous, like the smartest thing he ever did, because from that moment on, I couldn't do enough in terms of sending him dragons and, you know, everything he loved, magical.
That's awesome.
And, you know, we still have a great relationship today. He's like he's 17-ish.
Mm-hmm.
He's closing in on 18.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the Harry Potter generation.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's also relevant because it became, you know, when we're talking about my fairy goddess, godchildren, I guess, he is the first because it was his idea. And I just felt so great that he picked me. Nobody had mentioned that to him.
Mm.
He just said it in front of his children as I came in the door. And what was interesting is the connection was deep. It was like a spiritual or mystical connection.
Wow.
And I loved that. That was perfect for me. I'm a spiritual agnostic. Mm-hmm. I'm not religious, but I'm not atheist either. I love the, you know, the fantastical and mystical worlds. I just don't necessarily believe in them. Mm-hmm. I just accept them as part of the human experience, and I really enjoy them artistically, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense.
Sure, yeah.
So from archetypal perspective, from poetry, but whatever, you know, I love dragons. I was born the year of the dragon. So mm-hmm. it was all about dragons with him. So anytime I saw a great dragon while my travels, I'd get it for Charles, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he had a little sister
mm-hmm.
and she turned out to love fairies and wolves. And now she's really interested in wolves. Like, this kid knows so much about wolves. You just can't believe it. So I felt very honored to take that role. And I've really enjoyed it. And it's just bad, you know? I mean, I've got tears in my eyes. With my niece and my nephews, it's different. It's a little trickier when they're your siblings, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that gets into family, you know, politics.
Mm-hmm.
My siblings and I have had times in our lives when we were very close and times when we have been just downright estranged.
Sure.
And I have had to learn as I've gotten older that, you know, you can only be responsible for your own choices.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you just got to let it be. But the kids are different. The kids are just little people growing up, and those are their parents who mm-hmm. happen to also be your brother or your sisters.
Mm-hmm.
There's one girl and two boys, and they're all in their early 20s. So same thing with Charles Tim. I sent them all the fun things. I got to be the fun. I mean, it's not really fair. I don't have to punish them. I don't have to, you know, discipline them or whatever.
Right.
I get to send all the good stuff.
Right.
I get to be the person who believes in them on the outside and goes, yeah, you could do that. You've got the talent,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I sent them all the fun things, you know. My niece was interested in animals. She was very interested in marine life for a while. So everything was about that, anything I could find. My nephew, Xander, was very interested in going to MIT. He's really interested in engineering, very talented. So I would give him things like robotics books because that's what he loved. That was his passion. And, you know, whatever it was they loved, it was all about, you know, follow that passion.
Sure.
You don't know what's going to make a living yet. Don't let your parents tell you to study what's going to make a living. You study your passion and you do it well.
Mm-hmm.
And that will make you a happy person and you will do fine.
Mm.
You know, that's my message, which isn't always popular with the parents. But, you know, my other nephew, Aaron, is very interested in electronic music and DJing.
Uh-huh.
What is he studying? He's studying something he doesn't enjoy because his father does it and he thinks he can make money at it. He's studying software engineering. It won't hurt him. But his passion is music. And he's talented. So why doesn't he just do what he loves? You know, so my role, and I told him this, he's old enough. I told him, you know, I see my role in your life in part as being here to support you in your dreams, because I don't think at that age you really know what's going to make a living.
Right.
And I told him, you know, recently, like last summer, I said, I got news for you. Software engineering, not really a fun job, and quite cutthroat and very competitive. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you can't do it or do it well, but, you know, I mean, don't think it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. And he doesn't love it.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's about music for him. So again, you know, I know that he's into electronic music. If he hasn't already run into psychedelics, he will.
Oh, certainly, certainly.
You know, and his sister, she wants to go run off to Seattle to be a musician.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if she hasn't already run into it, she certainly will.
Sure.
They all know I'm here for them.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime they want to ask, anything they want to ask.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I see myself in that role in a nutshell.
That's great.
I also have an actual godchild.
Mm-hmm.
That's very special too.
Mm.
She is 10 this year, and she has, you know, I see at this point, you know, if there's been any influence, she loves art,
mm-hmm.
and she loves animals. Now, she may have loved art and animals without me, but, you know, what I did was I gave her a great deal of art-related gifts and animal-related gifts.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So you can call this propaganda if you like, but for some reason, when it comes from the outside and it's sort of a special person, I think that a child fantasizes a little bit and puts that person in a particular, I don't want to say a pedestal, but there's something that happens around that that is bigger than life. And that brings me to my own sort of fairy goddess mothers.
Uh-huh.
I thought about this just before you called, because I thought, where did this come from in myself? You know, why do I do this?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just so grateful for the people who did that for me. I have wonderful parents, and they are still exceptional parents. I didn't lack for anything, but I have to say the first people that sprang to mind, all women, Rainbow, Sarah, and Patricia, who was actually a mentor in grad school. But Rainbow, her name really is Rainbow. I was living in New Zealand. We were living in the middle of nowhere. I was a teenager. And she saw me as kind of a Miranda character, like out of Shakespeare.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I'd never heard of Miranda. I knew there was a Shakespeare because we studied him in school and it was all right. But I hadn't been really switched on to Shakespeare properly. I loved the theater, though. I knew I was going to study acting already. But she actually took me out to a hill overlooking the South Pacific. And together we read The Tempest.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And she told me why. She says, you remind me of Miranda and your father reminds me of Prospero.
Mm.
So I just was like, well, that's cute. You know, it just seemed a little irrelevant to me. My father was not that important at that time in my life. I was looking just like Miranda to go out to the island. So it was actually quite perfect. And I was all of 16. So she also taught me massage. She was a masseuse really well. She taught me good massage. And she was responsible for bringing me to my first belly dancing class.
Wow.
I turned out to win awards, and I did professional belly dancing for years.
Wow.
That was my primary dance form because my body type fit that dance form, and I had wanted to be a ballerina. And obviously, I can't be a ballerina with this body type.
Mm-hmm.
But belly dancing, it was sort of the body they all wanted. And my mother is Greek, so I had the natural flow with the rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. And it turns out to be important also because it's sisterhood, tribal, global dance.
Right.
And it's very trancy, very trance dancing.
Oh, definitely, definitely, yeah.
So I saw it that way. I never saw it as sort of, you know, like a striptease kind of thing. And it was always very serious to me. And I really got into trance state. So all that is Rainbow. Sorry. I have to say that was a fairy goddess mother.
Rainbow Sari, is that what you said?
That was her name.
That is, yeah. That's a hippie name right there.
Oh, no, totally a hippie. Wow. All the way. Oh, yeah.
That is classic.
All the way. Oh, yeah. And then Sarah Sugihara was a student of my dad's at the art school. She was this incredibly talented concert pianist that came to the art school, but her hands were really little. And so she wasn't able to continue because they felt that you had to have this big spread, you know, with your hand to be a concert pianist. So she moved into modern dance. She was gorgeous. She was super brilliant, very interesting. And she really liked us, you know, me and my sisters, but she particularly liked me. And so we connected. And so she was very influential in my life, too, especially in my teens. I think the teens are important. The teens are when you're coming out. You're just thinking about leaving the nest, right? You know, you're looking. You're looking for mentors. Now, again, no psychedelics, no drugs. But she was in the art scene in New York in the 80s. She worked with Tom Hulce, was one of her close friends. Most people know him from Animal House, but he was also Amadeus in Amadeus. Mm-hmm. And she was working with David Mamet at the time. So she was really in the scene. She's brilliant. She's still in the scene in New York. Mm-hmm. But she was very influential to me because she took interest and she really shared these things and she showed me that world. It was like she opened a window to the world that I wanted to be in. She was also heavy duty and very, very demanding and tough. And intimidating as hell.
Wow, that's awesome.
but that was a fairy goddess mother. She still is, like, in my life. She's in New York. But that's somebody I think back, and I don't know who I would be without her, is really what it comes down to. And then the last person that came to mind is an actual mentor who also was in theater. It was in grad school. This is Patricia Ziprod. And Patricia also had no children, which is interesting because Sarah had no children, too. Rainbow had one, but she didn't have one yet. And she was older. She was an older mother when she had one son.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I don't know whether that's either here nor there, but it's interesting that they were without their own children.
Mm-hmm.
So Patricia is one of the most influential theatrical artists of the past century. Mm. She really is. She was worked with Bob Fosse for most of her career. Mm. She's a costume designer.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, name the show, she probably did the first one on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I went to Brandeis. I turned down a full scholarship to Yale to go work with this woman.
Wow.
That gives you an idea.
Wow.
Yeah. And I have to say, she took special interest in me. There was a lot of private conversation. And I would not be the person I am today without her.
That's awesome.
So when you go to today, here I am, I've discovered psychedelics. Why? Well, I had my healing to do. I've led a really interesting life and it's quite extreme. And I had healing to do.
Yeah, don't we all?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So when I figured out this stuff can really help quickly break you through some of that stuff and free yourself of it, I was there.
Right.
And that was like 9 years ago now.
Mm.
So when I look at the, if you want to call it the psychedelic renaissance, which I think it is.
Oh, me too.
As life moves on, you know, turning 50 is huge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of a sudden I'm looked at differently by young people too, I'm saying. You know, like there's a shift that happens.
Yeah, so become recognized as an elder or something, right?
Yeah, it's not quite. It's like when I was in college studying acting, it was like Susan Sarandon was that person for me, you know? And she was, you know, very hip, but she was in that older, but not old yet.
Yeah.
You know, and she was someone I could look at and just, I couldn't tell you how old she was at the time. I just knew she was what I wanted to be someday.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the older I get, the less I'm able to really figure out how old people are.
I'm terrible.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know. There's somewhere between 35 and 53. I don't know. Like,
you know, it doesn't matter. The only reason it matters to me is it gives me a little bit of a perspective on where you were when you were, you know, where the times were when you were born. That's all. And you can't really assume either because people are so unique.
Right.
You know, you might be born in a certain era, but grew up in a different country, or you had a really odd experience like me. I was in New Zealand.
Right.
From 74 to 83.
Yeah.
But I was definitely an island girl when I came back to the United States. And when you go back to the woman, Sarah Subihara in New York, what was so amazing is that I literally was an island girl. But I had my sights on New York, and I had the talent and the ambition and the discipline and all those pieces. And she saw that. But
New York's an island. New York's an island too, right? So it's...
Well, it is. I never thought of that, but it's a very different island. You know? It's like, you know, if you can make it there and all that. But she was in one hand very supportive, and on the other hand, just it drove her crazy how island I was.
Uh-huh.
But this is before the internet.
Right.
You know, it's different today. And I really do think that that was one of the reasons that I caught the internet kind of boom in 1994.
Uh-huh.
Because I was in New Zealand and I was a young person wanting information and wanting to reach out. I knew the world was out there. I didn't have a typical island mentality. I knew there was something out there and I wanted it, but it was hard to get information from the rest of the world. You had to order books from the libraries. They had to come from afar. It was not like today. There were two channels on the TV. We did a lot of art.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
It is. What I'm trying to say is that here I am now in psychedelics, and I am getting a lot of young people, anything from teens through mid-30s, reaching out to me basically for advice.
Mm-hmm.
I see them as someone who could have been my child, and I feel really responsible for what I say.
Mm-hmm.
And I also remember what it was like to be younger. And you do want the advice, but you don't want the advice because you think you know it all. Right. You know, I'm not so old that I don't remember that. And you and I talked about this before, you know, age is relative.
Right.
For me, my husband is 12 years my senior.
Uh-huh.
And two of my closest friends here, John and Susan Sheldon, are just, she's turning 65 this week. He just turned 65. We just went to see a movie together, and he looked at me. He says, "I just want you to know this is the first ticket I've ever bought as a senior." And they're just fantastic. And we are so naughty, and we have such fun going out. And we're always stoned. We've been to several of the big ayahuasca retreats in the Amazon. We've had a blast together.
Mm-hmm.
But they're quite a bit older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, with my silvering hair, you know, I've got curly hair, right? So I've got all this white going through the curls now.
Yeah.
It's funny to me because they look at me like the young one. They really do. And I don't feel young.
Yeah, no?
No. I did for a while, but I don't now. Huh. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, I've felt in the last 5 years that I can feel this like sort of primal need to switch and go from being the receiver of knowledge to the like share the giver of knowledge.
Yes, I hear you.
I've definitely felt that recently. It was surprising, but I think even though sometimes I feel like I'm, when I think about like, well, when am I going to grow up, or when am I going to when does someone like start to think like an adult? And you know, I think that's the good thing about psychedelics is they. You know, they help you maintain neuroplasticity, and you have those opportunities to like get back into the mind of a child and see what's really important and what, you know, get perspective on your situation.
And I think it sticks too. I don't think we have to have psychedelics all the time to get there after you know, if you don't overdo the psychedelics.
Right.
You know, that, and for me anyway, I'm still pretty conservative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really just didn't feel that I needed. If you see some of my art from before psychedelics, you'd think I was on something.
Mm-hmm.
That same fellow that I was living with, Kevin, in undergrad, he used to say on occasion, "I just wish I could give you some acid and lock you in the room for the weekend with some canvases." And today, I used to look at him and go, "That's terrible." Uh-huh. And now I look and go, well, I can see why he said that. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's the fact that it's illegal sucks, too. I'd like to touch upon that because I don't trust the government.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, I choose to be in this country. I could live elsewhere. I am a patriot. I bought the propaganda as a kid here because clearly I believed in the whole, you know, liberty and justice for all thing because I came back. Mm-hmm. So I believe in the foundation, the good parts of this country, mm-hmm. you know, but I also see a lot of the, you know, the BS.
There's, I call it quiet corruption.
Yeah. You know, another ex of mine would have called it late stage capitalism.
That's a good term. I like that.
It's good. He fancied himself a Marxist-Leninist. He was the biggest capitalist I ever knew. Same one that took all my money.
Right? Oh, no.
Swear to God.
That's awful.
Yeah, so, but it's true, though. Because of that, I tolerated a great deal of Marxist-Leninist, you know, philosophy for 10 years of my life. So I learned a lot because actually he was a very interesting man and had some points. Uh-huh. So one of the things he talks about is late stage capitalism is different. There are certain elements of the beast that are sort of inherently, it feeds in on itself, becomes kind of cannibalistic. We're seeing some of that.
Yep.
And unfortunately, a lot of it's in our government. But when you look at it that way and you think, well, we're such a young country, and you think, well, wait a minute, there was slavery not that long ago.
Right.
I mean, still like in full on in front of everybody slavery. There's still slavery that goes on in the world, plenty of it. But right. back then it was like, you know, they were outside being sold at the market.
Right. Yeah.
You know, regular people had slaves. I mean, this is just not that long ago. And before that, we were wiping out the Native Americans.
Right. It is also Earth Day. And one of the things that you expressed to me that I wanted to definitely hear about was how your own medicine experiences have pushed you towards animal rights and environmentalism.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I've always been an environmentalist and I've always loved animals, but there was definitely some shifts that happened for me. I mean, I participated in my first ceremony in 2008. So ayahuasca ceremony. So I think it's funny. It's like, you know, if you do this over a period of time, it's a process. So you get to different parts of yourselves with the ayahuasca experience. And in the same way, this path has opened to me in the, you know, working for wilderness and wildlife, and they go together. You know, you can't have wildlife without wilderness, because wildlife needs habitat and it has to be wild. And so you first of all, that was the first thing for me, is realizing the connections. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have that big awakening of everything is connected. But there was something even more profound for me, because I realized that I had actually been seeing the plants, the forests, things like that, as the setting as opposed to the habitat.
Mm.
I was disconnecting it. It was, I loved it. I feel most at home in a forest or a jungle, but I did. And I love the critters. I always loved the critters. It was always about that for me growing up, you know, always about the animals, but I had failed to make that connection between the animals living in that environment and how intricate that is. And the plants did not seem like intelligent beings to me. There was no spirit in the plant. Well, there was a spirit in the plant, but I didn't acknowledge it in the same way as a critter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's part and parcel to my understanding of plant spirit, which definitely came from ayahuasca and being with Chris. You know, being with an ethnobotanist was part of it, because I'm also around all these wonderful herbalists who talk about plant spirit. So I knew, okay, these people are very intelligent, they're well-read, etc. So the plant spirits, to me, I was disconnected with them. I didn't see the plants as having spirit. It was difficult for me to comprehend what they were trying to tell me, these herbalists, ethnobotanists, but I was intrigued by it. And I felt like I was missing something. And I had all these plant people in my life. You know, I married a guy who was a plant person. My mother's a plant person. One of my best friends is a plant person. You know, and I love being in the forest or the jungle. So I realized, okay, that's part of what I'm missing. So I put that into this, even though I'm mostly an animal rights person. Uh-huh. I realized that you can't be an animal rights person without also being a plant spirit person, because it's all together. You can't have one without the other. Mm-hmm. You have to have habitat, for example, And it just blew open a whole new way of looking at life for me, putting that those two together. So that was one big part about it, looking at wilderness as habitat. And the big problem today, I just want to say this, and is they're talking about connectivity conservation. Mm-hmm. So they're talking about the same problem that happens in islands happens with wildlife. If you have wildlife that for some reason is stuck on an island, often the higher predators will begin to disappear because they don't have enough room to roam. So they're seeing this in our conservation areas that we set aside for wildlife, but the wildlife needs to roam. They begin to inbreed. They begin to get weaker and they eventually die. Mm-hmm. So we have a real significant problem with wildlife. So this gets back to, you know, the 7.5 billion and growing human beings on the planet, which is part and parcel to animal rights. I see animal rights as a human rights issue. Mm-hmm. I don't see it as separate. First of all, we're animals. That yes. comes into my ayahuasca experience a lot, okay? Uh-huh. Yeah, we're animals, but people don't think about that when they walk out the door. Most people don't think about that. I do. You know, my dad kind of was very clear about that growing up as a biology teacher, is that we are animals. Remember, you are an animal. You know, but we still separate ourselves. We still think we're better, more intelligent. We're quite arrogant that way sometimes. And I don't see it that way. I see us as absolutely an animal. And the more you study the other animals, the more you learn about yourself.
Sure.
It's quite amazing. So I began to really look at that, and it was my deepest pain. It was my grief that I was truly carrying, was this knowledge that we were wiping out the animals on the planet. And that there were good people fighting for it, but that we were losing the battle. So I started to bring that into the medicine space and ask the ayahuasca questions around how do I step up to the plate and survive this, looking at and working with what hurts me the most. You know, what is happening to these creatures? How am I going to do that? I'm not made of that stuff. I'm sensitive. I wasn't brought up that way. I was brought up an artist. You're supposed to be aware of your senses, and your emotions are supposed to be right there under the surface. That was my first question to the ayahuasca about animal rights. How can I handle this? Mm-hmm. And it was so cool. It sounds so strange to people who haven't done psychedelics, but I know this audience is open to these kinds of things. It was a Blue Morpho, and I asked that question very specifically. How I need something to help me walk through this battlefield and remain strong and not change myself, not lose my, you know, lose touch with my emotions, to remain the person that I am, but to be able to handle it. And mind you, you know, Chris and I had seen a lot of horrors with the rainforest devastation already. I knew I had been witnessing it. I knew how it hurt me.
Yeah.
I also knew that I needed to really be part of it. I couldn't not be part of it. I had to be a soldier in that. I hate to use the war terms, but it really comes down to being a love warrior to me. You know, it's all. And again, I feel like I'm talking to my own kind, so I can really be completely honest. But the vision was very, very quick, very strong and very quick. And it was surprising. I had this black jaguar. I had to be. It was absolutely clear that it was a black jaguar come to me. It was a male, interestingly. And it wasn't just black. It was black like the cosmos. It almost had like its skin was more of a delineation between our world and the cosmos, you know, nebulas and galaxies and things moving inside it. And it sat on top of me, laid on top of me the way one of my own cat friends, you know, that I had for many, many years, a really cool cat that I lived with, he would sit on my chest, and it was a male, as if to protect me and to own me a little bit, you know, very possessive cat. And he was very close to me. So it was definitely a cat spirit. And for a while I thought, well, maybe it's him visiting me, you know, because people get these visitations from, you know, people and animals from the past, and maybe it was, but I know cat spirit very well, so that makes sense. But this cat was this huge, huge jaguar, and it laid on me and it enveloped me. And it became clear that it was a shield. So I thought, oh my gosh, I asked for it and I got it. So here's what's cool about it. It's been years since that happened. Now this jaguar comes to me anytime I'm in an ayahuasca space where I'm dealing with something super difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It just comes up, kind of like in, you know, I don't know if you remember all the early Star Trek when they do shields up.
Yeah,
you know?
Yes.
Black jaguar comes around me. It isn't me, or maybe it's all you, you know, uh-huh. In this, who knows? But it's this protective entity that I have, a shield with which to go through and really face the most difficult animal rights issues possible. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about it is when I'm doing this work in the real world, you know, going away from the ayahuasca space, it's as if I can recall that black jaguar, whatever that is, that shield, I can bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
In my own life. I mean, it's not the same as when you're, you know, on ayahuasca, but it's there. It's, right. It's something happened to me. It mm-hmm. comes to me. So that's one big thing that really made a huge difference. But I've had many animal rights visions in the space that were extremely powerful for me and life-changing for me.
Mm.
The more I look into animal rights, the more terrible it is.
Yeah.
The deeper I go into it, the deeper I understand the issues. I'm kind of blown away by where we are. We're just plain wiping out the species.
Mm. Oh, yeah. So what do you think is the most critical issues that people need to address right now?
We just can't think it's all about us. We've lost our way.
Mm.
And we're going to destroy ourselves, too. So there's an insanity there. It's a self-sabotage as well. But we're yeah. taking down all these other extraordinary creatures. Anybody that thinks they're spiritual or religious and doesn't deal with the overpopulation issue is not being honest, because we can't be spiritual people and wipe out these other miracles of life. They're amazing. The other animals and wildlife they're nothing. We could not make these things. We could not come up with the creations that are out there. They're complex, amazing creatures. We don't even understand them. We're just babies.
Yeah.
You know, look at dolphins, for example. How can we possibly understand how they do that echolocation thing with their, you know, third eye, basically? I mean,
right.
We can't do that.
No.
We can't fly. Look at a hummingbird. Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
You could just go down this list and just say, we can't do these things that these other creatures do. But it's not just about what we can and can't do. It's the fact that they're themselves, they're having their own experience. We have no right to wipe them out.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very passionate about this work, to the point where I don't really talk about it very much.
Mm-hmm.
But I did, some of my visions in the space have been super helpful and very, very difficult. One of them, I was, you know, I spent that time in New Zealand. I had not been back to New Zealand for a long time since I told you about that experience with the young man
mm-hmm.
that was traumatizing. That was really the reason why I had not gone back to New Zealand for all those years.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, I was able to do that. And I did that with Chris, and we went back, and I had a wonderful time. And it was really interesting to visit after all those years. But when I came back, for some reason, maybe a connection that I'd made there, I don't remember how that happened, I discovered that there was a New Zealand dolphin called the Maui's dolphin, indigenous to New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really annoyed, because I thought, well, how could it possibly be that there's a dolphin in New Zealand that I had never heard of it? I wouldn't have known every single one of the animals in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are wiping out their own native dolphin, and it's an amazing dolphin. All dolphins are amazing, but it's a beautiful, teeny little dolphin. It's the smallest dolphin.
Uh-huh.
It's black and white and silver. It's really sweet and special, down to 55.
Oh, my. And what is it that's wiping them out?
Fishing. Unnecessary fishing practices. Mm-hmm. And they've known since 1970.
Oh, my.
The numbers are shocking. And there are many good people there fighting and fighting for it, and yet they can't get it past the government. So, you know, for me, that was just, I felt betrayed, and I was so angry. And I got in touch with the World Wildlife people there and the experts on it in New Zealand, and did a lot of work for them. And I knew that this was one of the most difficult animal rights, you know, activism work that I'd ever done. So mm-hmm. I needed again to go to the medicine space and say, help me with this. I don't want to be obsessive about it. I don't want it to take over my relationship. I don't want it to just destroy me. It's so mm-hmm. depressing.
Mm-hmm.
New Zealand would be the first country to wipe out a marine mammal. Not the first to wipe out a dolphin. China has that honor, but it was a river dolphin.
Mm-hmm.
But the first marine mammal, New Zealand would go down in history as being, you know, for that extinction.
Mm-hmm.
And they still do it.
Mm.
Okay. So I remember being at Nihui Rau. And I said, well, you know, I'm in the middle of this work with this Maui's dolphin, and I would really like to, I don't know, ask the ayahuasca how I can handle it. And I got this most amazing vision where it was very, very intense and vivid and beautiful. And Ricardo did an exquisite job sort of weaving this, oh gosh, like a geodesic dome of medicine, you know, grid, if you will, but just overlapping with the Icaros everywhere surrounding me. It was really trippy and wonderful. But he liked the idea because it was this interesting thing. You know, they see the dolphins as different. They have river dolphins and they kind of are scared of their river dolphins. They're not really looked at as wonderful things, which is probably really why they still survive, by the way. Yeah, they have myths that are, you know, the dolphins steal the girls and take them to their underwater kingdoms. And of course the girls drown.
That's so interesting.
Oh yeah. No, you didn't know that. It's a wonderful myth and interesting. And most of the people on the Amazon rivers will have that story, but that's possibly why they're still there. You know, there's still some pink river dolphins because when they see a dolphin, they think, kind of not an evil spirit, but definitely something to, you know, watch out.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas to us, we have this whole other mythos around dolphins, right? Yeah. So for the first thing was Joe Tafur describing to Ricardo the difference of how I felt about dolphins and the way he felt. And he seemed, I could see from his face, you know, that with the interpretation going back and forth, that he was really interested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I felt like he was going to be there with me. And he says, you will see your dolphin tonight. So I went into the space and this was just extraordinary. It was as if I was in the underground kingdom, but it was all water. There was nothing else. I could sense that I was in the middle of the ocean at the deepest part. And I could just sort of sense that it was in our, you know, in our earth somewhere in the ocean, but there was the land masses and the bottom of the ocean were so far away that they may as well not have existed. And I was floating in the middle and it was fine. Underwater. And then suddenly this perfect, gorgeous little Maui's dolphin, just straight out of the iconic photograph that I'd been working with, kind of zooms out of the water towards me, over to my left, in my left sort of sphere of vision, and just sort of as if it went up on its tail in a leap, just looked at me and just was like welcoming me. And he was like, He brought all the other dolphins of the world into the same vision. It was as if he was saying to me, thank you for joining the fight to help us. It was the most amazing, wonderful little spirit, so sweet and loving. And he brought all these other dolphins from all over the world, and they came in pods, just like hundreds of different pods of different species of dolphins. And I have to tell you, I didn't even know there were different species of dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
I thought a dolphin was a dolphin.
Mm-hmm.
No. There are many dolphins and they're all quite different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So all of these dolphins came and they were all the same, just sort of hovering in the water, looking at me, surrounding me, as if to say, thank you for joining us, as if I was just one more human. And they had been doing this initiation or this welcoming for centuries with other humans like me, who were finally going to help on the, you know, non-underwater world. It was intense and beautiful. So that's one of my visions that was very profound. I mean, it's hard to describe them, you know, it really is. But the other one that was much more difficult, and I will share it, but this one was at Temple of the Way of Light. Very, very wonderful place, beautiful ayahuasca, fantastic shamans. I went deep and I have no idea where this came from. I didn't expect it. I was working on wolf issues, but I'd come a lot farther in my work. And so I was learning some of the really basic things I needed to learn about what is the problem. So the greater problem of wildlife and animal rights, which is connected, but it's different. You know, farm animals. Our animals we use, domestic animals and animals we use for food, is a different issue, but it's also a very, very important issue. They're animals too. Mm-hmm. So in this vision, it's a classic ayahuasca experience. I have been working on the computer since 1994, and so I've developed these little systems of saving files, and I have a PC. And so mm-hmm. when I come across something in some of the social media that I belong to for animal rights, that they force feed you these hideous photographs demonstrating what it is really like out there, what is really going on. Some of them are just so horrible that many people like me can't even look at them. Mm-hmm. I know the power of an image is very important because you need to see it. But to dwell on it is dangerous for somebody with a big heart.
Yeah.
So what I would do is I'd snapshot it in my mind, have a very visual mind, and I'd right-click, save it into a folder, one of two folders, animal rights horrors and animal friends. The animal friends one was like miracles and beautiful things about animals, mm-hmm. really lovely shots that I liked and that were inspiring. But the animal rights horrors folder I rarely, if ever, even opened to just glance at. But I knew what was in there. I don't have a fully functional photographic memory, but it's pretty damn close with images. Mm-hmm. And in the medicine space, I had the experience of having to open that folder.
Oh, interesting.
And every single one of those images opened as their own folder and as a moving image. And I thought, oh God, I know what I'm going to have to do tonight. And I didn't shy away from it. I allowed myself to feel for each and every animal. Mm-hmm. And it was that compassion thing that happens in the ayahuasca space sometime where you actually really feel the pain or the love or whatever of the other creature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for instance, there was this hideous photo of this hills and hills, rolling hills full of these plastic boxes with veal calves in them. And just the most horrible thing. You just can't even think of the horror of like what kind of human, what humans would do that? You know, to take a baby, rip it from its mother, stick it in a little crate where it never sees the sun. It mm-hmm. can't, it knows no love. It never sees another of its kind. Mm-hmm. It gets fed maybe nicely, maybe not, from a little window, and then it's slaughtered. I mean, it's just unbearable to consider the reality of that life and the kind of person who would be able to do that on such a scale or at all. So in my vision, I had to endure the way it felt as one of those calves. Mm-hmm. And it was so profound. I can't tell you, Jonathan, it was so sad, and yet it was so sweet because they're such sweet creatures. Mm-hmm. And they're babies.
Yeah.
So, you know, going back to the psychedelic parenting, you know, for me, an animal baby is a baby too.
Yeah.
I really truly feel that way. I think they all have rights too. I mean, somebody who can harm a baby animal, there's something wrong with them to me.
Yeah.
So I went through this with every single one of those photos that night. And it was really intense. And I came out of it with positivity because I'm a positive person. One of which was, okay, psychedelics does something very interesting. First of all, we as humans do not have the ability to see infinity. We can't comprehend infinity. Mm-hmm. We can try to poetically or philosophically, but we can't see it. In the psychedelic realm, for some reason, we're able to understand or to comprehend it differently. So I was able to see the real numbers, for example, of the veal calves. Mm. I didn't just see the one image which showed several hills. I saw several hills multiplied by how many veal calves are treated that way around the world every year.
Well, I can't even imagine.
I saw all of it, and I did this with every single one of those situations. It was intense. But what it also showed me was what I'm trying to express is the power of psychedelics in the human mind to allow us to see something, to comprehend something we can't comprehend in regular waking life. We can try to show it in graphs. We can try to show it in art, but we can somehow really experience it with psychedelics. I think that's really important. And I also came out of there with an understanding that I have a really good mind and I'm very lucky. I was quite grateful for my brain. And I felt, okay, that was my message. Mm-hmm. My message is, I have a good brain, use it.
Yep.
That's yeah, it. Those are the ones that come to mind the most, and there have been more, but they're heavy. I think it has to do with human ethical evolution. I know I'm not alone in that, and that feels good. But I do think that if we don't evolve, this is the one thing I've learned from wildlife work is how evolution works. You can see a species break up into subspecies, and sometimes those subspecies can be quite different from each other. One can be much more, smarter and kinder, and another can be much more violent. For example, it's not just physical. You know, most of the time we're taught in biology, oh, well, this particular one came out like this and has, red feathers instead of yellow feathers, and or is larger or is smaller. That's the way our science has identified them. They haven't identified them as much with behaviors. But if you look at them and you look at the behaviors of the subspecies, you begin to say, what about us? How are we evolving? How will we evolve? How do we want to evolve? And that is the question.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I see the animal rights as human rights. I really do see them as the same. We are animals. We cannot forget that.
Right. Yeah. One of the things that Dennis McKenna always likes to quote that the medicine told him was, what is it that he says? Wake up, you stupid monkeys. You're ruining everything.
Yeah, you stupid monkeys. He loves that. Yeah. we call it the crazy ape.
Right. Crazy ape. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. We have this. It's Chris and I have a kind of, we have this little code because we see horrors all over the world. You just can't even imagine. He sees way more than I do.
Uh-huh.
But, sometimes we'll be going through something that is just beyond comprehension. You just can't believe people live in this environment. And we look at each other and one of us will go crazy ape or crazy apes usually because you just think, really? denial is a very strong protective device.
Yeah. Cognitive dissonance.
Unbelievable. We are really something. I love human beings. I love us. I think we're wonderful. And I am positive and I do tend to always want to look at the positive. But I think it's important that we also look at our weaknesses and our mistakes and, try to get better. So I could go on, but that's enough probably.
Yeah.
I would say one of the young ladies who I'm a fairy goddess mother to, the one who loves wolves, she turned 13 today, and she got her first present, which was actually adopting a wolf at a conservation center in Salem,
cool.
New York. Mm-hmm. And it was just so lovely to get her text about how much she loved that.
Mm-hmm.
Just to know, to feel like, okay, I kind of introduced her to that, and she really took it on. And who knows? Maybe she'll be a wolf activist someday or a biologist, I don't know. I mean, she doesn't have to be that, but how wonderful that we have that together.
Yeah, definitely. That's
great. So I felt like I passed that on, that love of another species. And one species, when you learn about it and you really give your heart to that, you'll open yourself up to another. And the more you learn about other species, the more you learn about your own. And the more you care.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you.
So that's my Earth Day message. Every day is Earth Day. We have one Earth. That's it.
That's it.
The habitat I was talking about?
Yeah.
That's our habitat. That's it. It's a finite structure.
There's a lot of empty black death out there around this planet. So there's not much else we can do but treat this one with love and respect.
Yeah, I mean, we can't expect to have another one, and we don't deserve another planet until we get this one right.
Yeah, good point.
We really don't. I mean, it scares me when I think about us going off and doing the same thing to other planets. We need to evolve to where we're handling this one well. And I love this planet, by the way. I mean, I'm sure there are, I feel that there are many other planets because it makes sense just in sheer numbers. If you look at astronomy and astrophysics, it's just, we would be foolish to think that we're the only ones. But this one is amazing and wonderful, and I love it. I just have such love for this planet.
So me too.
So for me, it's loving this one, loving it. And if you really love it, you take care of it and protect it.
Yes, indeed. I agree.
So, yeah, that's really my heart of hearts, I have to say.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Okay, lots of love.
All right. Bye.